Our first speaker today will be Christine Kochenour. She is really a legend within the critical care community, especially for trauma. She is the section chief in the surgical critical care. She is also the surgical critical care associate program director and currently a professor of trauma, acute care surgery, and surgical critical care at the Department of Surgery at UC Davis. And I'd like to say thank you.
Thanks for that very kind introduction. And I don't have any relevant financial relationships with any commercial interest that pertains to the content of this presentation. So some of the potential etiologies in acute trauma can be a tracheobronchial injury, pulmonary contusion, severe lung injury requiring pneumonectomy, aspiration, which we're going to hear about a little bit later, inhalation, such as chlorine gas, or I had one episode in Texas where the person was mucking out a large volume tank and got overcome by the fumes, and the stuff that he inhaled was something that they use to solidify water when they're drilling. And so you can imagine what it did when it hit his lungs, as well as ARDS from either concomitant infection or sepsis. I'm going to present a couple of cases illustrating some of these and some of the things that you have to think about. So the first case is a 25-year-old man who was brought to the emergency department following an auto versus bicycle with severe dyspnea, desaturation to 80%, a non-rebreather mask, is a GCS of 15 at that point in time. Had multiple rib fractures on the right, had a right tension pneumothorax, right chest tube was placed, large continuous air leak. It was intubated because he had continued respiratory distress, tachypnea, although it did improve a little bit after his intubation. And chest x-ray that we got afterwards, after we put that first chest tube in, the pneumothorax was actually larger. We put a second chest tube in, and it too had a very large continuous air leak, and he had even more difficulty with oxygenation and ventilation. We took him upstairs to the ICU where we did bronchoscopy. He had a near complete tear of the lung from the bronchus. And at that point, this is something that you have to think about whenever you have somebody that you can't ventilate, can't oxygenate, and you have a large air leak from your chest tube. So you can either do, if they're stable, you can even do a CT, but in this case, a bronchoscopy, and we actually used it as a therapeutic modality because we had to be able to close off that broken bronchus, if you would, and we used the bronchoscope to direct the endotracheal tube down into the opposite side where we could do one lung ventilation. But remember, you are ventilating one lung, so you need to change your vent settings until you can get an anesthesiologist in with their dual lumen tube and off you go to the OR to repair it. This is an example from the internet that had a very similar history. And you can see that you have almost like a little bit of a hump of the lung there. And this is sometimes referred to as the fallen lung sign of Kump. And here you can see it on this particular x-ray. And keep in mind, chest tubes that are in suction are going to steal that tidal volume, leading to more respiratory distress until you can actually get to a point where you're in the OR repairing this. A second case is a 10-year-old who fell about 6 feet into the path of a trailer that then ran over him. Ended up with trailer marks over his chest, abdomen. He was hypotensive, had 70% saturations on a non-rebreather at the scene and on his arrival to the emergency department. And this was his original admission at chest x-ray. You can see that he had significant pulmonary contusion even immediately. And that's usually a very bad sign. He was intubated when he got to the emergency department. The injuries that were found on his workup included a skull fracture, multiple facial fractures, a right pneumothorax, pulmonary contusion, possible aspiration, multiple liver lacerations, multiple pelvic fractures. And throughout the ED, he did maintain his oxygenation in the 80s, upper 80s, and his blood pressure initially. And this is the chest x-ray that you see after he was intubated. This is after the chest tube was placed in the emergency department. And you can see that left lung is continuing to white out. He was transferred to the PICU, but his blood pressure continued to drop. His resuscitation continued with transfusion of blood products. They had to call interventional radiology for hepatic and pelvic angioembolization, where they did find bleeding vessels from the, or bleeding from the pelvis. And he had continued to have increasing difficulty with oxygenation and ventilation. And this is 4 hours after admission. SATs went as low as 39 to 42%. On a conventional ventilator, they were able to get them to 60 to 70, especially with hand bagging. He was placed on inhaled nitric oxide, with SATs improving into the 80s. He underwent the embolization of his pelvis, again, complete worsening hypoxia. As you can see, that left lung is continuing to white out. Both HFOV, high frequency ventilation, as well as APRV were attempted, but he desatted down to the 30s. And this x-ray is about 8 hours after admission. Left chest tube was placed for concern that he may have a pneumothorax that you wouldn't necessarily be able to see. Pressure control, 25. Tidal volume of 370. PEEP was at 18. His eye time was 1.8 seconds. Respiratory rate was 16, 100% on his FiO2. And the INO was at 40 parts per million. SATs, with all of that, were in the 80s. And this was 10 hours after admission. He was evaluated for ECMO, but because he had just been embolized for his bleeding from his pelvis as well as his multiple liver lacerations, they decided to wait to start VV ECMO until 6 hours after control of his bleeding. At 20 hours, he was placed on ECMO, 27 French Avalon catheter with a heparin bolus for initiation, and then he went on flow without heparin for 12 to 24 hours. And you can see this is 20 hours after admission on ECMO. Obviously, the lung is starting to look better already. Overall, he had decannulation on post-injury day 4. He was eventually discharged to rehab. In your toolbox, you need to be able to have a plan for your mechanical ventilation, volume control, pressure control, and SIMV. To do a whole, to go over the data for ventilation on a patient with ARDS would be a whole lecture, actually a whole seminar in and of itself. But obviously, lung protective strategy with volume control, using ARDSnet principles, or potentially neurally adjusted ventilatory assist, APRV, or high-frequency percussive ventilation. Neuromuscular blockade is another tool in the box, as well as prone positioning. An inhaled nitric oxide, potentially surfactant, has been used in the past, and ECMO. And I got this slide from Matt Martin, who very much thanked for this. ECMO is something that you can use in trauma. There are no specific diagnoses that are absolute indications or contraindications to ECMO. You need to achieve hemorrhage control and correction of coagulopathy prior to any cannulation. TBI, advances in circuit technology, and successful ECMO use have been done without systemic anticoagulation. I actually had another patient that I placed on ECMO who had had a TBI, who ended up, again, with a four-day run on ECMO with marked improvement in his lungs and with a small epidural subarachnoid hemorrhage and did quite well from that. Some contraindications to ECMO are going to be a non-survivable injury or comorbid condition. Vascular disease or an injury that precludes a successful deployment of ECMO. So if you can't cannulate the patient, obviously it's going to be very difficult to put them on ECMO. And some of the relative contraindications are when you have had more than 7 days of mechanical ventilation or potentially chronic end-stage organ dysfunction without transplant candidacy, or if they are at an advanced stage or have severe frailty. When do you start to think about ECMO? Anytime I'm starting to get to a point where I'm thinking about putting them prone or inhaled nitric oxide, actually if I'm on to inhaled nitric oxide, I've already started getting my ECMO people there. And so presence of severe ARDS or respiratory failure with severe hypoxemia or inability to ventilate, refractory to conventional therapy. Really need to have a pre-specified pathway of ARDS care, including paralytics, prone positioning, and advanced ventilatory modes should be attempted prior to ECMO. Timing for initiation, usually you want to see it less than 7 days of mechanical ventilation. More than that may end up making or requiring a longer ECMO run. And one possibility is to consider using inclusion-exclusion criteria from either the CESAR or the Eolia trials. And I'm going to stop there and turn it over to my next speaker. Thank you.